We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Radio and online at WILL.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. How has what science learned about genetics affected the practice of medicine? What ethical dilemmas have emerged? How are they addressed? Our guest this afternoon is a medical geneticist who has written a book about some of the extraordinary cases he's seen and the extraordinary people he's met and cared for over the years. Our guest is Dr. Robert Marion. He is the author of Genetic Rounds, Doctors' Encounters in the Field That Revolutionized Medicine. The book is a collection of essays Dr. Marion has written over the course of the past 20 years in which he examines what he calls the human side of doctor-patient interactions. Listeners, join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Robert Marion is professor of pediatrics and obstetrics and gynecology at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. He's also director of clinical genetics at both the Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx and Blythedale Children's Hospital in Valhalla, New York. His previous books include The Intern Blues and Learning to Play God, The Coming of Age of a Young Doctor. His new book, Genetic Rounds, is published by Kaplan. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The phone numbers if you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon. Dr. Marion, good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Good afternoon to you, Celeste, and thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. You say early in the book that all of medicine is now nothing more than a small, insignificant subspecialty of genetics. How has the sequencing of the human genome changed medicine?
Well, clearly, as time has passed, what we're finding is more and more that all human disease has a genetic component. You know, some of that may be blatant, as in the case of sickle cell disease or Marfan syndrome or cystic fibrosis, disorders that are caused by clear alterations in known genes. But, you know, every human disease, high blood pressure, cancer, asthma, schizophrenia, really any disease that you can name is caused by an interplay between genetic factors and environmental factors. And with the ability to sequence the genome, what we're finding is that we can identify some or all of those genes. Eventually, it will be all of those genes. And so we'll be able to take what has been a field in which you wait for people to develop symptoms and then treat those symptoms to one in which we know, because we've tested people before they've become sick, that they're going to develop these symptoms later on, and we can try to prevent those symptoms from happening by altering the environment in which their genes are being expressed.
Mm. Are more and more medical students now going into the field of medical genetics, clinical genetics?
Well, I think that's not that's not the case. There are still, you know, medical geneticists are still a small segment of the population, the people who do what I do. But all research, anybody who does, you know, in the old days, if you were becoming a cardiologist or a gastroenterologist, you would do research involving, you know, clinical studies, the way the heart worked, different medications that might work on the heart. Now all the research that's occurring in fields is focused on identifying the genetic basis of it. So really what's happening is that all the subspecialists are becoming geneticists. They're not really training as medical geneticists, but they're getting more knowledge about how the genes work and using that knowledge in their chosen subspecialties.
Okay. So then the education of medical students has changed.
Yes. Yeah. And will continue to change and needs to change as time goes on.
Yeah. In medical school, you became hooked on genetic counseling. Why?
I don't know. I came to medical school with an interest in genetics, and I can't really explain what it is. I mean, a lot of people, I'm chairman of the admissions committee at our medical school now, and everybody has a story about, you know, they want to go to medical school because their grandmother was sick and a doctor made the grandmother better. But I didn't have a kind of story where, you know, there was a genetic disease in my family or I knew somebody who had a genetic disorder. There was something about this field, something about this information that just intrigued me. And I think part of it is, you know, the geneticist needs to be a generalist, needs to take the information about every different system of the body and try to put it together. It's almost like solving a puzzle. So I'll get I'll find out that a patient has this problem with the heart and that problem with the liver and has this finding in the eyes, and we'll try to assemble those pieces into a single diagnosis that explains all of that. And so in a way, it's like solving a puzzle. And I think that's something that really originally brought me to the field.
It is interesting in these essays that you've written that are contained in this book, Genetic Rounds, you're detective, diplomat, and advocate.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a tall order.
Yeah. I think as a geneticist, as a medical geneticist, I really have to know that, and I have to approach patients that way. You know, there are instances where I'll see a patient in the waiting room or see a patient immediately coming into my office and will immediately know what's wrong, you know, because that's what I've been trained to do. I've been trained to, again, it's kind of a Sherlock Holmes kind of thing. Sherlock Holmes said, I've trained myself to see what others have overlooked. And that's really what happens with the medical geneticist. We focus on a facial feature and say, oh, this child has Williams syndrome. And I then know, knowing the diagnosis, that in the next hour, I'm going to have to break this news to the family. I'm going to have to get them to understand what the meaning of this is and how this is going to change the rest of their lives and the rest of the lives of the kid. So very much so, the person with the disease, the person who's referred for the consultation, is not necessarily the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one of the patients, but the whole family becomes the patient in these kinds of situations.
Yeah. When and how did you begin to realize that as a geneticist, your patients include more than, say, the child with a genetic abnormality, but the family and the extended family?
Well, I think, you know, this happens just kind of as a regular part of our work. I'll go to the bedside after a baby with Down syndrome is born and make the diagnosis of Down syndrome. And, you know, I know what to do for the baby who has Down syndrome. I know that There are heart problems that may be associated with it. I know that there are intestinal problems that may be associated with this condition. Things that we need to address in the newborn period, as well as developmental problems that occur later on. But, you know, those are issues that will resolve over the next day or two. But going to the bedside and talking to the mother and telling her that her child has Down syndrome immediately causes, it evokes an immediate response that needs to be addressed right away. The mother will start to cry, will need attention, and so she clearly becomes front and center, the most important patient. And it really is just a matter of experience, going to the bedside and telling parents this information that you just naturally have to come to the conclusion that the patient is not necessarily the person with the disease, but other members of the family.
Yeah. Would you tell us the story that you tell in the essay, Scotty's funeral?
So Scotty was a baby who was born at one of our hospitals. Actually, was born outside of our hospitals, but was referred in. And he had a number of congenital malformations. He had a number of birth defects. And coming to see him the first time, the neonatologist called me because they were concerned about the possibility that he would need to be put on a ventilator soon. And I saw him, and I knew almost immediately that he had a condition called trisomy 13. Now, trisomy 13 is a lethal condition, meaning that virtually everybody who has it dies within the first year of life. Somewhere between 5 and 10% of babies with trisomy 13 survive the first year. So my job in this case was clearly, there wasn't much I was going to be able to do for Scotty. I was going to be able to make him as comfortable as possible, but the number of internal malformations that he had basically decided his fate before I arrived at the bedside. What I needed to do in the case of Scotty was tell his parents about what was happening, get them to understand that he had this condition, that the condition was going to ultimately cause his death, that there wasn't anything that they had done to cause this problem, because there's a lot of guilt often associated with the birth of a baby with problems, and get them to go through the grieving process, the mourning process, so that ultimately they were able to go on with their lives. So clearly, in his case, the parents were the patients.
Mm-hmm.
Scotty was kind of a minor patient in this drama. He and they were interested in knowing, you know, what would happen with him. They ultimately took him home, and I helped them get to the point where they were comfortable with him dying at home. And in fact, on the last visit that he made to my office when he was a couple of weeks old, I took them through the scenario of what would happen when they found him. Usually, babies who have trisomy 13. Die of respiratory problems. They stop breathing. They have basically sudden infant death syndrome. So they're often found in the morning by their parents in their cribs. And so I told them what would happen. I orchestrated his death, basically. I said, you're going to find him, you know, probably find him in the crib. He's not going to be breathing. They asked if they should call the ambulance. I told them that they probably should do that. They probably shouldn't do CPR because they had already agreed to a do not resuscitate order.
Mm-hmm.
And I told them about how to go about making arrangements for the funeral and you know, giving them what I was hoping to do was give them control over a situation that they had no control over, that they could understand what needed to be done, and then be able to do it. And that's exactly what happened. He died one day his parents found him in the crib. They called the ambulance. They brought him to the local hospital where he was declared dead. And the story is set at his funeral, with me coming into the funeral home after having a terrible week. I had just had a miserable week. I had patients who were sick and dying all over the Bronx. And I was questioning whether I was doing anybody any good in this job, and maybe I should find something better to do, something more fun, something where people actually got better, because they didn't get better in genetics. I came in, and they, during the course of the funeral service, they expressed how important my interaction had been to get them to this point, to get them to be able to function at the funeral of their very much loved son. And it was clear to all of us, it was certainly clear to me, that they were going to be able to get on with their life at this point. And I realized at that point that I was doing some good for somebody. I wasn't doing any good for Scotty. There was no chance that we were going to be able to do any good for him. But clearly his parents benefited from the intervention, the interaction that we had had during the very short course of his life.
Yeah. His parents are pretty remarkable people.
Yeah.
In your experience, do parents, other parents, do as well as Scotty's parents did? How do people, can you give us something in a general sense of understanding how it is we go through this process, we sort through tough choices?
Well, you know, I think that an important thing that I have to keep in mind, that everybody has to keep in mind, is that everybody is different. And the way that people cope with the way that people cope with tragedy and the way that people cope with bad news is different depending on all sorts of factors: how you were raised, what your religious beliefs are, you know, who in your family how people in your family have dealt with these issues in the past. And, you know, I think that it's important when I start interacting with a family at the very beginning to kind of, that's one of the things I look for when I'm taking a history. I take their emotional pulse, basically. And sometimes I'll find that it's a religious connection, that having them reach out to their priest or their minister or their rabbi is important in getting them to feel comfortable. Sometimes it's there are things that I that they say to me that I can use in coming back to them. So it's very variable. I don't think that you can really generalize about this because it's different from patient to patient.
Do you often go to funerals for your patients?
I pretty much always go to funerals for my patients, and it's kind of an interesting thing. I think that most doctors do, but I'm not sure. I have a friend who actually met her husband at a funeral of one of her patients. So I think some good things can come out of this also. But I think it's important to the family, and it's important to me to see that. I also, I'm in the Bronx, so a lot of my patients are Latino and are Catholic, and it's a Catholic tradition. I don't know if it is in other religions as well, to have a mass card at the funeral, and I collect these, and I have them in my... I'm looking at them now. I keep them in my pocket, in my card case. And when I'm, you know, I occasionally, when I have a few minutes, I take them out and think about the people who I've cared for, who have died, and you know, again, what they've taught me and what I've learned from them.
What an interesting way to hold on to one's perspective.
Yeah, it sounds pretty morbid and weird, though. you think about it.
I don't know. I don't know about that. Well, in one of the essays, the essay Andrew's Parents, you write at the close of this, in practicing medicine, providing for the emotional needs of the family both at the time of the initial encounter and then on an ongoing basis can be as important, if not more important, than the provision of physical care. I wonder how many physicians are able to practice that kind of medicine.
I think, unfortunately, fewer and fewer, just because of the demands that are placed on physicians' time due to the fact that in order to make a living, you have to see a certain number of patients. I'm kind of in a luxurious situation here because as an academic physician, I get paid a salary, and it doesn't depend on how many patients I see in an hour. So I get to sit back and be able to talk to people and to understand what they're feeling and why they're feeling it. I think, you know, physicians today are very much rushed and don't really have this luxury.
What do you think is on the horizon for healthcare in this country, and what would you like to see?
Well, I think, again, that there's we're in the midst of a revolution, and that things are going to change dramatically over the course of the next 25 years. I think that in the future, because of the breakthroughs that have occurred in the Human Genome Project, we're going to know at the time of birth through the newborn screening process, which currently screens for a couple of dozen diseases rare diseases in young children, but we're going to know all of the mutations and polymorphisms, that is, changes in the DNA, that occur in each child, and we'll know what conditions those mutations and polymorphisms will predispose this child to develop. And as a result of that, we'll be able to say, you know, little Johnny, who just went home from the hospital, carries a mutation in the COMP gene on chromosome 22, as an example, that's going to predispose him to develop bipolar disorder later on in life. So we need to prepare for that possibility. You know, there are families where there are individuals who are going to be predisposed to develop cancer, and there are other members of those families that are not going to be predisposed to develop cancer. And there are people who are going to be predisposed to develop diabetes. And, you know, by altering their nutritional status, by monitoring them more closely, by intervening in ways we can't even think of now because we haven't really had any success in altering the genome yet, but that will be something that will happen in the future, we'll be able to prevent these diseases from occurring before they've actually manifested themselves. So I think that's going to cause a major change in medicine. And a lot of the, you know, it's now a lot of the medicine is reactionary. We react to things that happen, and we, in order to try to figure out what's happened, we do all sorts of tests. We do imaging tests. We do blood tests, and this is where all the expense comes from. But knowing this in the future, we'll be able to cut down a lot of this stuff, and I think actually eventually the cost of medical care is actually going to drop rather than continue to go up. So I think that that's something that will happen, again, within the next 25 years. It sounds like a brave new world. And
there are
clearly negative, there are negative parts of this. Who gets to know this information? What if you have, do you get insured as a result of having a mutation in a gene? I mean, that's already been dealt with through the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, or GINA, as it's called. You know, do you get life insurance? All sorts of ethical issues that we haven't really started to deal with yet, but this is all changing. The technology is already there for a lot of this, and will continue to get ramped up over the course of the next few years, so that I think that this is all of medicine, the way that medicine is practiced, is going to change dramatically.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Robert Marion. He's a medical geneticist. He is the author most recently of Genetic Rounds, A Doctor's Encounters in the Field That Revolutionized Medicine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, now that we can look at one's genetic makeup and say, there's a good chance that we might be dealing down the line with bipolar disorder or diabetes, those are two conditions that we have therapies for. What if there are currently no therapies, or there are no therapies on the horizon? What do we test, and what do we do with that information?
So it's a huge ethical dilemma. There are scenarios like this currently. For instance, there's a disease called Huntington's disease, which is an autosomal dominantly inherited disorder passed along from parent to child. Huntington's disease is a neurodegenerative disorder that usually begins to manifest itself at about the age of 35. People who have it develop a movement disorder, a cognitive impairment, and psychiatric impairment. And within about a 15-year period, they become essentially vegetative. There's no treatment for it. But if you're the child of an individual with Huntington's disease, you have a 50-50 chance of also developing it. And because we know the genetic basis of it, we can test for it. So the question is, should we test for it? Should we take somebody who is at risk for developing Huntington's disease and offer them testing for this disorder, testing that will tell them whether they're going to go on to live essentially a normal life, or whether they're going to develop symptoms of this disorder and ultimately die of it. People who I've dealt with, people who have come to me for this testing, have looked at this from different angles. I mean, some people say, look, you know, if I have it, I have it, and I need to know that because I need to figure out what I'm going to do with the rest of my life, whether I'm going to have children and subject young people to this kind of uncertainty as they grow up. Some people have said, well, if treatment becomes available, then the people who are going to be treated first are the ones in whom we know that there's the mutation. So I want to know that, so I'll be ready when the time comes that a treatment becomes available. But there are other people who have been tested for this disorder, find out that they're affected, and commit suicide because they can't bear to think that they're going to have to go through the same kinds of problems that their loved one went through when he or she manifested the disorder later in life. So this is just the leading edge of this dilemma that I think we all of society is going to have to deal with as genetics becomes more and more sophisticated.
Mm. We've got some listeners who would like to speak with you this afternoon, so let's take a couple of calls now.
Sure.
Listener in Chicago, Line 4, good afternoon.
As Admiral, as all the things you're talking about and expecting to obtain and benefit from, we still have the current environmental conditions and degrading and ruining some of our health as a result of the chemicals and pesticides and herbicides and who knows whatever else. cosmic rays and everything else under the sun that could be happening. But the fact that we have hormonal interceptors and one thing or another disrupting our body, and then you have other people playing a doctor on their own by going to a special pharmacist for particular hormone regulations for aging, and so we're messing around in a over-the-counter kind of way with the things that we're doing, rather than seeking the help that we need for things. But the environment is really ruining a lot of our ability to even maintain our health, let alone the good things that we're anticipating doing. So I thought I'd offer that as an important fact.
I think you can't underestimate the importance of the environment. Again, I think everything has a genetic underpinning. But what we're finding more and more is that the genetic underpinning is affected by all sorts of agents that come in contact with it. In the old days, we thought that the genome was pretty much static and didn't change. That identical twins, for instance, shared the same genetic material from the time of conception through the rest of life. But what we're finding now is that changes that occur to the genetic material caused by agents in the environment alter the way that genes are expressed and change the features of, for instance, of identical twins. So identical twins are not really identical in the sense that they share the same exact genetic material. Kind of interesting. But I think we can underestimate the importance of environmental factors and how they work on the genome.
Let's take another call. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm going to toss out a real-life issue and get your reaction to it. My sister was just diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and she was told that it has a genetic component, and therefore I am more at risk than I might have been for Parkinson's disease, as is others in the family. Where does one find out what risk I have? Probabilistically speaking, what do I tell my children, and where do we find that information?
A very interesting question. This is a condition that clearly has a genetic predisposition. It's what we call a multifactorial disorder, one in which there's an interplay, again, between genetic factors and environmental factors. And again, if you have a genetic predisposition to this disorder, having genes expressed in the right environment or the wrong environment, depending on how you look at it, will bring out the features of this condition. So being the sibling of an individual who has Parkinson's disease, you are at increased risk of developing this disorder as time goes on. Your risk is probably about four times as great as that of the general population, and again, that's what we usually, and the only reason I can say that is because that's the usual risk for individuals who have multifactorial disorders when compared with people in the general population. Unfortunately,
is that the same for my children and her children?
It's the same for her children. It's less than that for your children because you haven't manifested the disorder.
Right.
So it's the same. That's the risk for all first degree relatives. That
right.
is siblings and children. But your children are second degree relative of somebody
right.
who's affected. So the risk goes down to a little more than the rest of the general population.
Okay.
That happens.
Where does one get this information about the environmental factors and what one would do or not do?
Well, that's a problem. We don't have that information yet. I mean, these are all theoretical risks, but we can't do at the present time. At some point in the future, we'll be able to do a test and see if you carry the gene that makes you eligible, basically, for getting getting this disorder, the susceptibility gene. Unfortunately, we don't have that ability yet, but that will happen over the next 10 years or so.
Thank you.
You're
My
welcome.
Pleasure. Thanks.
Other questions, comments for our guest, Dr. Robert Marion, are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. A few minutes ago, we were talking about some of the ethical issues involved. And one of the things you mentioned that lies ahead is altering the genome. What kind of ethical issues lie ahead there?
Well, again, we have some experience with this already. We have the capability, the technological capability at this point, to do genetic engineering. We can take a gene that's not working in a particular disorder, attach it to a virus, and infect an individual who's missing or whose gene doesn't work properly with that virus and get the gene to express itself. This has already successfully occurred in a disorder called severe combined immune deficiency, or SCID. This disorder causes, obviously, a serious immune problem, and children who had this were the bubble boys, you know, the bubble children who had to live their lives in bubbles. So this would be a major boon to anybody who had this disorder to be able to reconstitute basically their immune system by introducing the gene that is not working in them. And so this was tried. There was a clinical trial looking at this, and 14 children were given the virus, and they all but two of them reconstituted their immune system. But within a year, one of the children developed leukemia, and within another year, a second and a third did. And it turns out that what happened was the virus inserted itself within the genome in a particular place that turned on an oncogene. So that was one disaster that occurred as a result of this. But another one that really brought about a moratorium on all this research occurred about 7 years ago now in Pennsylvania, where a child with a disease, an adolescent with a disease called ornithine transcarbamylase deficiency, a disorder that's called a urea cycle problem, was part of a clinical trial for genetic this genetic treatment. And he had a very mild form of this disease, and he had just volunteered because he wanted to help humankind. He got infected with the virus and developed multi-system failure and ultimately died as a result of the effects of the virus on his body. And as a result of that case, that child's name was Jesse Gelsinger. He's known to everybody in the genetics community because he's had a major effect on our world, really. There's been a moratorium on using this technology in humans. So, you know, this is not something to jump into lightly. There are big issues. Eventually there will be stem cell treatments available, and that raises a whole other issue, which was we've all experienced over the last administration, the presidential administration. You know, it's just a matter of ironing these things out and moving ahead.
Our listener in Chicago who called in earlier has a follow-up question for you. So let's go ahead and talk with this gentleman again. Line four, go ahead.
I accidentally cut myself off here. I regret doing that. My question touches upon what you just said, stem cell research and therapies. There seem to be some promising things on the field that are occurring now.
Yeah.
I was wondering how well they look to you.
Oh, they look great. I mean, I think that there's untold promise in stem cell research in trying to reconstitute the nervous system and other parts of the body. I think that not to get political here, but there were a lot of bad things that occurred over the course of the Bush administration. But probably the thing in healthcare that impeded progress the most was the ban on stem cell research, because that has basically taken people who my father had a stroke about 10 years ago, and had there been stem cell research going on, I think by this point we would have had some treatments for people who had strokes, who had neurodegenerative disorders. But because that research wasn't allowed to go on, we wind up way behind the eight ball here, not able to provide anything. My daughter is a veterinarian, and there was no ban on research, on stem cell research in vets. Vets are now offering stem cell treatment for arthritis in dogs and cats, on a regular basis. So I think that we've become way behind because this became a political football.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're coming down on time, and there are a couple of issues that you mentioned early in our interview when it comes to helping parents of children, of infants or young children with genetic abnormalities. Guilt, shame, and denial. It seems that these are tough nuts to crack. How can we better get at those in terms of where we are as a whole in society? There are a couple of stories in this book, The Reunion, an essay, and a story about a little guy by the name of A.C. Sheridan that raised these problems and bring them forward in a very moving way. And we don't have time to really tell the stories.
Right.
But maybe you could comment on that.
Sure. Well, AC's story, I think, is really something that should be highlighted. AC is a kid who has a severe craniofacial malformations that makes him look really, there's no other word for it, grotesque. His mother takes him out in the street. He's now 16 years old. His mother takes him out on the street, and people don't just stare. Their mouths drop open. And, you know, the fact is that if you see something unusual, if you see a person who looks different, we're not trained to react to that person. Nobody tells us, oh, you shouldn't stare. You shouldn't ask questions. And so his mother has spent her life as a mother to this child yelling at people who really do inappropriate things when they see this kid around. And I think an understanding of the fact that everybody is a person, some people look different than other people, you should always be respectful no matter what the situation is. If children were to learn that, I think the whole world would be better off. Unfortunately, AJ's AC, I don't remember what I called him in the
AC.
AC's mother, all of the names have been changed, so I can't remember.
Yeah.
AC's mother has decided not to bring her kid out in public. The only time she brings him out is when she comes to the doctor's office. And so this kid has become basically a prisoner in an apartment in the Bronx because of the fact that his mother is trying to protect him from the stares and the comments that people make about him.
Yeah,
pretty bad. And the guilt part of it, I think, these are terrible disorders because they're passed on from parent to child. So you can't say to a parent, oh, it's not your fault, even though they didn't have any control over it, because they know that the gene was in their DNA and that they passed this mutation on to their child. and cause this problem to occur. So it's important to kind of talk about risks and the fact that, you know, you didn't want to cause this. It's not something you had control over. This is just the way that genetics works.
Mm-hmm. There, we'll leave it. Dr. Marion, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me, Celeste.
My pleasure. Dr. Robert Marion is a medical geneticist. He is the author most recently of Genetic Rounds, Doctors' Encounters in the Field That Revolutionized Medicine. The book is a collection of essays Dr. Marion has written over the course of the past 20 years in which he examines what he calls the human side of doctor-patient interactions. The book, Genetic Rounds, is published by Kaplan. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from Chicago and Kansas City. Here's Tom Rogers.
Thanks, Celeste. Good afternoon. We've got an unchanged day pretty much in the wheat market. Very flat prices as we finish the trading day on this Thursday. Corn finished the day up, but a sharp increase in soybeans. We'll talk more about that in our segment on the closing market report coming up at 2:06 this afternoon, a special program from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention, where our Dave Dickey and Todd Gleason are today. Taking a look at the Kansas City wheat trade, the December contract had a high today of, let's try to find the opening price and the high, low, and close, but we're not seeing that right here. We will start here. There we go. 545.5 was our high today. Our low is 526, and the settlement price is 535 a bushel. That was down 0.25 cents. March wheat had high 561, the low 542.25. Settlement price 550.25. That's down 1.25. Now onto the Chicago Mercantile Exchange wheat market. The December contract, the high 541.75, the low 522. The settlement price 531.75, no change on the nearby contract. March had a high of 561.75, low 542.25. It settled at 552.25, up 0.25 cents. May finished up 0.25 cents. The high today 572.5, the low 557. Settlement price 565.25. July had a high of 585.25, the low 565. Settlement 576.5, unchanged. September wheat 601 the high, 583 the low, 593.5 settlement, and that was unchanged on the day as well. There was movement on the corn pit, and that was downward. The high in the December contract, the nearby contract, was 398.25 today. The low 382.5. The settlement price 390.5, down 3.5 cents. March, the high 413. The low 397.5, settled at 405.75, down 3.5 cents. May had a high of 422.5. The low 408. Settlement price 415.5, down 3.75. July had a high of 430.75, the low 417.75, and the settlement was 423.75, down 4 cents. September corn, 438 the high, 424.75 the low, 431 settlement, down 3.75 cents. And Dease corn of 10, the high today 446.75, the low 432, the settlement 438.75, down 4 cents. Now to the bean complex, where the nearby November contract had a high today of 988.75, the low 955, settlement at 982.25, up 18.5 cents on the day. January, the high 996.5, the low 961.5, and the settlement price at 990 a bushel. That was up 18 cents. Moving ahead into further next year, the March contract, 1001.25, the high, 968, the low, 995.75. The settlement price for the end of the day settled up 16.75 cents. May had a high of 1002.5, the low 973. The settlement price, 998.75, up 15. July of 10 soybeans, the high 1006.5, the low 978.5. Settlement price, 1003.75, up 14.25. And the same price on the August and September contracts, the same increase, rather, on the day on those two contracts. August had a high of 1004.25, low 980, settlement 1004.25, up at the high. And September had a high of 991.25, the low 975.5, settled just under the $10 mark at 999.75. Again, that was up 14.25 cents. Now onto the products. The December soybean meal contract had a high of 302.20. The low 286.50 and a settlement at 301 even, up 1190. Big increase on the January contract, too. The high 290.60, the low 278.50, settlement at 290.50. That was up 9 even. And no movement at all in bean oil. December had a high of 38.63, the low 37.79, settlement at 38.37, unchanged. And January, the high 39.06, the low 38.15, settlement price in the January bean oil contract 38.79. Again, that was unchanged. Join us at 2:06 after NPR News for a special commodity, or not commodity week, but closing market report with Dave Dickey and Todd Gleason in Kansas City at the NAFB convention. They'll have interviews with people that they've talked to over there as they wrap up their convention tomorrow. And we'll bring you the closing market report live today and tomorrow from Kansas City. I'm Tom Rogers.
Now let's take a look at what happened today in Chicago with the livestock contracts. December live cattle, the high today 83.60, the low 82.80, the settlement 82.85, down 80. February 85.50, the high, the low 84.80, the settlement 84.82.5, that down 110. April 88.12.5, the high, the low 87.47.5, finishing today at 87.62.5, down 72.5. June live cattle, 85.20 the high, 84.55 the low, 84.57.5 the settlement, that down 95. Feeder cattle also finished lower on the day today. November, 93.50 the high, 92.95 the low, the settlement, 92.95, that down 37.5. January, 93.50 the high, 92.40 the low, 92.50 the settlement, that down 97.5. March, 94.10 the high, 93.25 the low, the settlement 93.47.5, down 50 cents. April feeder cattle, 94.90 today's high, the low 94.20, ending the day at 94.32.5, down 42.5. December lean hogs, 54.80 the high, the low 54.27.5, the settlement 54.45, down 115. February, 62.35 the high, 61.20 the low, the settlement 61.35, down 182.5. April, 67 even the high, the low 66.10, finishing at 66.17.5, down 172.5. And May lean hog, 71.60 the high, 70.75 the low, the settlement 71.20, that down 105. February bellies finished down 45 today, 85.30 was the high, the low was 83.20, the final 85.05, again that down 45. On Wall Street, the Dow is currently off 81 points at 10,211. The Nasdaq down 15 at 2152. The S&P 500 off 10 points at 1,088. Nearby crude oil in New York down 252 at 76.76 a barrel. Coming up later this afternoon on The World from PRI, small businesses need computer-savvy workers. An American not-for-profit is finding and training them in refugee camps around the globe, an online path out of poverty, outsourcing tech jobs to the poor. That story in the day's news coming up this afternoon at 3 on The World here on Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. It's coming up on 2 o'clock. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our technical director this afternoon is Henry Frain. The producer for the afternoon magazine is Harriet Williamson. The forecast for Illinois and